This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Dr. Doug Reed, and I am located in Abigwe, the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
My name is Dr. Matthew Stranick, and I am on Treaty No. 8 territory, the traditional meeting grounds and gathering places of our First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest, it must be admitted, somewhat irregular in the series for the third season of the AdNonTech podcast. Matt Stranick with you. Pleased to be here, of course. And as ever, the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed. And what's the doggo's name, pal?
This is Jasper.
Okay. Some of you who follow along on the Instagrams will recognize this pupper from the pretty much daily, if not daily, semi-daily series of videos that appear on the platform with the inestimable Dr. Doug and the inestimable Dr. Doug's dogs out and about in various parts of what kind of outside Charlottetown-ish kind of thing for PEI?
Yeah, rural PEI.
Rural PEI, okay. Yeah. That should be significant to anybody. It's not just PEI, it's the rural part of PEI.
Oh, yeah,
just,
not the busy part, not the urban.
Right, not the highly urban, you know, not the skyscrapers.
You talk about skyscrapers, it's still tour boat season. So the big cruise ships come in, and they are taller than anything else.
From St. John. Yeah, when the cruise ships show up, like each of those things is a city unto itself.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of population, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of services,
yep.
In terms of, floating economies of such, financial and otherwise. So, I'm glad to be here. We just went into this whole long pre-show kind of thing where I vented about stuff, let's be real. It's a privilege to wake up any day and be an educator in any kind of context. That's my honest opinion. And I just feel like, we missed an episode last week. It's been kind of, there's been sort of a heavy atmosphere, I want to say, in as much as we're coming out of National Day for Reconciliation holiday, which, it's meant a lot to me. I spent 2 weeks prior to Reconciliation Day teaching Indigenous narrative within my English class. And now as a preamble to kind of going into poetry, where I've spent a good amount of time having the ability to talk about people who I actually know, right? So moving from a pretty spiritual-ish kind of viewpoint from the Indigenous narratives and into the English poetry, right? The sort of mediation between, sound and meaning, right? Words and music. So it's kind of a nice place to land. And, going into the Thanksgiving holiday weekend coming up a week from tomorrow, isn't it, Doug? Thanksgiving.
Next weekend.
Right. So reconciliation, Thanksgiving, all of that stuff is in the air, so to speak. And so coming together, bringing things together, collaborating, working for the communal benefit of the family and sort of the larger context, that's sort of where I'd like to think of where we're going with this episode, which is all about academic disciplines and silos, which Doug and I have been pretty both explicitly and implicitly against through this show, I think.
Yes.
We're pretty all about the collaborative constructionism and building things together. And I mean, I'm trying things out in my class where, you know, it's cool to be able to act on some of this stuff. So I appreciate, from my standpoint, Doug, the topic this week. What brought you to this in particular now, if I may ask?
I've been a science educator now since 1991. And some stuff gets up my nose. Like, I don't like when people own words. I don't like the gatekeepers that own things. And when I talked about science, I was in a conversation with somebody where they were like, oh, well, STEM isn't really science because it's interdisciplinary. And I'm like, bug off.
Right.
I don't have a nicer way to say it than just bug off, take your gatekeeping and go away. And then I started looking into science ed more because I published in that back in the day. And I just kind of wandered away. I slid into technical, like technology, technical engineering stuff more than general science. And I just wanted to come take a look at it and say, why do we have these silos? Why do these people think they own these particular words? And I just, being a lifelong learner, we get to wander and explore stuff. This is something I wandered and explored. So that's why I wanted to talk about that today.
No, absolutely. And I think, again, sort of as we're getting into the third, you know, season in between summers where we record this show,
yeah.
I think it's sort of a good way to kind of look back a little bit on what we've been up to thus far within the show and sort of position it within a forward-looking context, right? As we get into the darker period of the year, as we get into the time of autumnal renewal, as it were, things falling apart to reconvene into different formats, as it were, you know, all that good stuff, right, that we kind of think of when fall is in the air. So I appreciate the, you know, timing of this particular one, I suppose, honestly. And again, just for me, as somebody who's working in a frontline education role again, in an academic department made up of a pretty wide set of disciplines. Again, what I'm finding that I value about my role beyond and above the teaching stuff, which is it's very much so, is being within and among this sort of cohort of pretty progressive educators from across their various disciplines. And so, you know, having an awareness of that multidisciplinarity, having the ability to leverage that and sort of bring enhanced kind of enriched learning experiences to students through that perspective, all of that to me is really compelling. So again, I think that there's a lot of value to this topic at this particular time, my man. So yeah, so what else we got here before we, wow, your first one's going way back in the Wayback Machine, man, for the references.
Oh yeah.
Way back.
I love history. So yeah. To find Dobson from 1908.
08 of the 1900s, people. Of the
19. Yes, so 116 years ago. And it's the function of philosophy as an academic discipline. And I didn't dig into the philosophy bit a whole lot, but Dobson does a great job describing, like, the non-silo life that is the way
I like
to put
that.
It.
I like that term, the non-silo life. That's good.
Yeah, so he talks about the relationships of physics and chemistry, astronomy, biology, psychology, and he says, yeah, we need to have specialists in those fields, but there's got to be a bigger picture, because he's trying to open the bigger picture up to say philosophy. Philosophy needs to be a science in there. And I found it really interesting because scientists used to be called natural philosophers. That's before the word scientist was coined. It was natural philosophers. And I love that. And I just wanted to position the beginning of the podcast in a place before the rigid boundaries really got set up.
Absolutely. And I definitely appreciate the shout out to philosophy, both within that paper and also within your rationale for including the paper. And I mean, to that extent, the only authors who I really have time for lately, outside of stuff that I'm kind of tapping into for my classes, remain Marcus Aurelius and the Stoic philosophers of around 300 BC to around 200 AD, give or take. They kind of had a 500-year run where they were, again, this is something where, you know, things that rely on words and concepts before there's a physical evidence of their proof. Cormac McCarthy's kind of final genius novels that he shared with us, Stella Maris and the Passenger, which I was on about earlier this year, like January and February kind of thing, where, you know, that's kind of the heart of those novels for this character, math prodigy. And basically one of the things that kind of drives her to the precipice of a, you know, mental and spiritual crisis is the fact that for all of the abstraction, you know, for everything predicated on something else, you know, anything to do with mathematics is fundamentally, you know, it cannot be other than an idea, despite whatever ripples and, you know, it has in the real world. It remains something that is, you know, relies on faith, as it were, an idea. And so whole philosophy, natural philosophy, it's the basis for math, Aristotelian logic, right? All of these things that we tend to value in Western culture, that are a value in Western culture, I think are spoken to that reference there, pal. So I think that's a good one.
Yeah. One thing I really like, just to continue on, is when I got my first degree, I did a BA in history, and they forced me to take courses other than history courses. Right. Like, mm-hmm. I had to take the one English course. I had to take like a classics course. I had to take an economics. I had to take a religious studies. I had to take a science. Right. And at the time, I was like, why are they making me do this? And now I get it. Now I understand. You need the breadth of everything. You need to look across all kinds of things to figure out where you're going to go and what you're going to learn and how everything connects together. And now I really appreciate it, because some of those courses I just loved so much, more than the actual history courses that I was forced to take.
I did a very elective heavy BA. I kind of, in my original, you know, arts degree, I, like a lot of people, I sort of tried a few things on the way to what my major ended up being. I picked up as many philosophy courses as I could, just because I had a real significant interest in it. And I ended up taking, just to kind of, I went from being like sort of under consideration for doing honors and kind of going into being a professional literary scholar, to being, well, let's just get you what you need to, get your degree and get you out of here, son. That's sort of how it was going for me. So I self-subscribed my last year and a half of courses to just, I don't know, stuff outside my discipline, right? As much as I could, like religious studies, you know, history, because that wasn't my major. And the taking those kind of second year / third year courses during my third / fourth year, it had the benefit of kind of enhancing my grade point average. But it was also just kind of really interesting in and of itself. And the purpose of an arts degree is to give you a well-rounded kind of education and the ability to read, write, and think at a higher level than what you were able to going in. And so generally speaking, the curricula for an arts degree does tend to favor holistic approaches, right, in and of itself. And so that's where our colleagues in the hard, quote unquote, sciences and hard, quote unquote, technology areas may kind of put down their nose as saying, well, that's all subjective. That's all, you know, hooey gooey fairy tale kind of qualitative stuff. You know, Where's the tangible applications? Well, I say, to go back to your point, Doug, you don't have to go further than philosophy for those tangible applications. That's how close those tangible applications actually are.
And one cool thing that I just thought of that I haven't thought about in years is a buddy of mine was doing his PhD in education, and he was living with a guy doing his PhD in geology. Oh. So when you talk about hard sciences, the geology student would look at the amount of work the education student was doing. It's like, you're nuts. Why are you working so hard? You have to put so much time and energy. He goes, I take the rocks and I put them into the machine. They test it, and then I run the numbers, and then I'm done. Like, I don't have to do all that thinking and all that connecting. So when it talks about hard sciences, your science is way harder than mine. And I'd never thought about it that way before you just mentioned that. So it's...
Well, it's a lot of hours going into investigating an idea. Yes. And because you are at times dealing with, you know, things that exist at a conceptual level, you got to make sure that your methods are tight. And then once your methods are tight, you got to make sure that you're actually following, you know, a reasonable line of inquiry, that your approach remains consistent, because you have to be able to say why you did everything. Otherwise, people will not look at what you're trying to achieve seriously. And so one of the things that I think from my doctoral study particularly that kind of landed for me is just that notion. You have to be able to say why from the get-go. From, you know, your very first paragraph of your thesis document has to refer to your justification. And if it doesn't, then it's suspect. And so, like, when I'm in the context of marking my students' papers and stuff, I mean, I spent the first 2 weeks just figuring out even who my students were, figuring out what they're even good at. Like, okay, I'm going to build evaluation measures that suit the cohort that I have, as opposed to, you know, coming up with something that I just find on the internet or whatever, right? It's important. So, like, part of my investment in my time was, like, building the rubric, getting the students' files such that I can, you know, put in their correct info. And so then they can see, with the application of a template on their evaluation forms throughout the semester, evidences of challenge, evidences of growth. But yeah, it takes building that structure the first couple of weeks, which, you know, it's meant I've had to scramble a lot to get caught up on my marking is what it means. And I'm still going to be doing that tomorrow, thank goodness for afternoon classes. But still, the point is, speaking holistically and to the thing at hand realistically is the objective of an arts degree, I think. So,
yeah. And when we look at that infrastructure that you just talked about, that leads us to Stitchway 2001, The History of Scientific Disciplines.
And 113 years later, folks. 103, sorry. 103.
So it's disciplinary classifications originated in the early 19th century, and it seemingly discrete knowledge within the European Academy. And that summarizes where we've gone, how the structure was set up for the infrastructure, and then how in Western post-secondaries through the 20th century, they just got entrenched. And I only brought it up because this is coming from the European Academy, and I'm doing some work with some indigenous research right now. And what does the European Academy have to do with indigenous ways of learning and land-based learning, right? Like,
You didn't tell me that. Have you put that on Facebook? Is this the first time I'm hearing about this?
No, I'm helping write a textbook on some stuff.
I do a show with this guy once every 2 weeks or so for the past 2 years plus at this point. And you never fail to surprise, Dr. Doug. That's all I'm going to say. Like, okay, my colleague who I'm on with all this stuff and whatever, it's like, all right, friendo, good to know. Dr. Doug is writing a textbook. We're going to keep up on that. That's not something we're going to let go.
Well, I'm the second author.
No, man.
Somebody else got the did the beginning research and put the application together and had the topic, and I get the help, which is
that's
perfect.
Legit.
I love
it.
Yeah, I love being the second person.
That's awesome. Always lending a shovel, right? To a project.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, exactly. I do not need my name in lights. It's what can I do to help? Because this is what I have to offer.
That's exactly it. It's nice when something just kind of lands in front of you with like, okay, this aligns with what I'm already interested in, what I've got some experience at, what I'm kind of good at, arguably. But more to the point, it's just, you know, it looks like fun stuff that you can, you know, sort of help advance something cool, right? And that just becomes a matter of like, you know, as you get further into your career where, as you say, Doug, it does not matter. I don't care if I'm first, second, third author on a thing. I don't care, like, if I get credit for, you know, this podcast as such or anything. I mean, it's just like I am interested in what the thing can do out there in the world and whatever can be done to help that along. It's just, you know, to the benefit of the people who are encountering it, who aren't me, because I got my own motivation. I got my own everything.
Yeah.
I want, as an educator and just as a human being, my whole objective for this is for other people to get value. Because for me, the value of this is in creating it and putting it out there. That's my own joy. Somebody else is coming at it from a completely different standpoint. And in the interest of, you know, getting something towards them that they can actually use, I mean, that's the whole name of the game, isn't it? So
it is. And for me, I've never liked that first author, second author foolishness.
Yeah.
And we talked about that previously. A prof that I had in Calgary once described group work like that, because there was a class, group work got assigned, and you can imagine one of the groups self-destructing, right? Like that's, there was no guidance on how to do the group work. We were all adults. We were all professionals. And one group, and then the people sat down. Well, this was my bit, and that was my bit. And then the prof said, you don't understand group work because it's all yours. It's not this. You don't own that. Everybody owns everything.
That's
and
right.
If you could say this bit is just mine, then you didn't do group work. You took a project, divvied it up, and you each did a bit. And I could see where it connects. It should be seamless, but I could see where these slides were this person, those slides were that person.
What you just described makes me think a couple of things. It's first of which is why I avoid using group work, actually.
Yeah.
Group work stresses people out, man. I don't know. I just, like, when I look at the people in my class, I'm like, I can, you know, make some opportunities. I have it so that they can do a thing in a group of two if they want to. But that's as far as I go. It's like this whole, there's going to be four of you. And it's just like, No. Arbitrary groupings, like, I mean, there's so many diversities in terms of people's, you know, learning styles, and I hate that term, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. Yeah.
You know what I mean. The way that people engage with learning generally, there's so many international backgrounds, there's so many cultural variations. In the contemporary post-secondary classroom, I have a person who's 58 years old as a student, who came to my class, you know, came to my office hours to talk about his grade, right? And it was awesome. 58 years old, 12 years older than me. And then I got kids who are, I mean, kids, they're like almost my son's age, like 17. I have 17-year-olds. And so, you know, how it's like, I'm going to force, like, you know, a 58-year-old to work with a 20-year-old. It's like, no, I'm not doing any of that. Okay. That's just poo-poo on that. And then, wow, I just went on a tear against groups.
No, here's what I do that's slightly different.
Okay.
I do group work with students, so the students have to work together, but I do not do a group assessment.
Ah.
Right. So they work together. They have to communicate. They have to build and create and all the rest. But when they get a grade on something, it is not on a group, part of a group project. So their grades are completely separate from the learning opportunity that they could have had, because the assessment's about what they learned, not what, oh yeah, one of my friends is a graphic designer in my group, so they made everything look pretty. Right. No. So I like to split it up that way.
Well, and then there also, I mean, and this is where I do start thinking, and just in terms of things that I've heard in teaching and learning seminars and the like, it does put me in the mind, for instance, in terms of promoting accountability. It would be very easy in such a group situation to have, you know, self-evaluation built into it. And then you just, it's an extra layer for you as a teacher to mark. But if you have, like, going into it, an awareness that other members of your group are going to be, you know, there's going to be like a mark, you know, or 1 to 2 to 3 marks for the entire semester built around how well they function in a group vis-a-vis a self-evaluation that they administer. And they have to provide a rationale for their grade. The times that I've done that in the past, most students actually give them, tend to be honest. You know, you expect them, like, give myself 5 out of 5. Like, nah, most students will give themselves like the second mark down from the top, weirdly. And then, you know, you can kind of scan it for evidence of, as you say, a seamless delivery or a compartmentalized fractured delivery. And, you know, you can just build some features into it where if a group has reached a point where they're not able to function, then you just have a checkpoint where the group ceases to function as a group. You give them a disengagement point instead of being arbitrary. I just think that there's ways you can customize the situation with certain kinds of assessment and evaluation processes.
And that leads to Kirshen in 2009, what are academic disciplines? Because when we take a look at that, Kirshen talks about interdisciplinarians, right? We like the seamless boundaries. We don't want to see that our academic work generally happens within narrow and possibly arbitrary or artificial disciplinary boundaries, because it prevents academics from seeing bigger pictures, from seeing the connections that could happen, from seeing the synergies, and just having that knowledge. So when we're talking about groups and how we're doing it, that's another example. I prefer the seamless to the here's my bit, here's the math bit, here's the physics bit. It's like, give me a break, guys. Like, are we creating new knowledge or not?
Right.
It's like when I went to STELE, the Society for Teaching and Learning in Higher Ed, that conference
awesome
that putters around.
Yeah, I've been for a while, but the times that I went, it was awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I went to one in Halifax in like 2017, I think. Okay. And I went to this session because it had a great title and it was all about, oh, here's some fantastic stuff to do in your classroom. And it was two business instructors. And they had stumbled into a bunch of stuff teachers have been doing for 25 years. But it was new to them because they were in their silo. And so I got there all excited to take notes. And I'm like, oh, man. So yeah. I sat through it. But it was like, yeah, I've been doing that since 1994. I learned that in the 80s. It's like, this exists, but it was new to these people, and there were other people from different silos in that room learning it for the first time. So good on them. Like, it was good for them. They got the publication, they got the information, got spread to more people. So wasn't it wonderful? But the silo stopped it from spreading out earlier. So it's just Kirshen talking about narrow and arbitrary, and it's like, ugh, I hate that.
Well, and again, a lot of this is simply due to, I mean, even the publications themselves come out of largely publicly funded, primarily publicly funded institutions of post-secondary learning, and the publicly funded mandate means that I mean, these institutions are stewards of the public purse. It is incumbent upon anybody participating on funding from the public purse to show their tangible financial value and contribution. And so I do think that the association between grants, the association between funding bodies and organizations, and how those funds are delivered to institutions and individuals sort of promotes really just kind of being hyper narrow on your research phenomena, which does tend to be good practice, right? Having a good narrow thesis statement is kind of the, you know, be all and end all of the, you know, quote unquote scientific method. But when it just becomes, you're trying to justify dispersal of public funds into individuals' projects, it does tend to suggest, you know, proprietary ownership over endeavor, which tends to cause people to look inward rather than outward, you know, manage tightly, effectively, financially, viably, perhaps more so than, you know, a wider ranging endeavor typically might, I think. But
you know what you just described?
What's that?
Cognitive territories.
Okay, cool.
That's, you just described it. You just did a wonderful job of dealing with cognitive territories, because I dug into that too because I couldn't help myself. But thank you. That was perfect. I assumed you had skipped down and looked at the next reference because you just covered the next reference, the Telemann point.
Well, I'm grateful that the flow of your references here and our dialogue are kind of nicely synced up here. There's a certain serendipity to the conversation, like you almost planned the order for these that you were going to speak to in advance, in as much as they were going to facilitate a certain kind of conversation. Ines Goldenfree has some moves, people. He does have some moves.
Yeah, so Telemann 22, it's a societal territory of academic disciplines. And one of Telemann's comments is, this is the basis of disciplines, cognitive territories. And Telemann talks about how the division of labor structures modern disciplines, and talks about the cognitive structures of shared sets of concepts, questions, references, and methods. And I get it. I used to teach engineers. And literally, I would say 95% of the engineers that I taught were cookie cutter students, right? This was in Australia, right? They all had like the flat top. They all had like the pocket protector with a pencil in it, right? They were wearing golf shirts. They were wearing khakis. And I was like, this is weird. It was like their uniform, because this is what worked for them. And then there was a couple that didn't. But the majority of them is like, nope, here's why we're here. This is what we want to do. They were ultra focused on their topic, which is fantastic. I love when people find their niche and then they're in it and they thrive. Like, I think it's amazing. So, but it just, your comments just reminded me of this, like the cognitive territories. And then the fighting between. It's like, no, you don't own that. This is us. This is our definition. We own that word. That's
well, I mean, again, there's at the very root of it, there's paid employment and livelihoods and backyards, mortgages, and kids' soccer lessons at risk. So, I mean, we've reached the point as being like modern human individuals that instead of slaughtering each other with sticks, you know, to preserve your cave entrance from invaders or intruders, you're having, you know, these kinds of territorial pissing matches, I suppose, vis-a-vis bureaucratic and academic structures. It's just kind of, there's the reason people get so like tweaked into these rhetorical and professional battles. A lot of it is really like this primordial reptile brain that's still largely unevolved, the modern human, you know, psyche is largely predicated on this sort of advanced bit of cranial matter, which we've dealt with to give us better spatial and abstract reasoning and, you know, ability. I mean, the part that actually deals with strategy and situational awareness and kind of gives you the basis for communication through language and the like. I mean, that's the new adaptation. That's like the new adaptation. We're dealing with, you know, so we're dealing with stuff and emotions and sensibilities that are pretty deeply programmed into our fight or flight, you know, destroy other mammals for eating or defense purposes. And those kind of echoes make themselves known wherever they can be. And so, yeah, man, it's a hard situation.
And I'm going to jump back in time to Friedman 2018.
Please do.
And how the creation of too many academic departments stifles creativity, encourages a silo mentality, and increases administrative bloat. And
administrative bloat. I enjoy that term. That's good term. That's a good one.
Yeah. So the silo mentality is an attitude found in some organizations where departments or groups do not want to share information or knowledge with other individuals in the same company. The silo mentality reduces efficiency. And that's where we're at. Like, can we be more efficient? Because what I want to do is help people learn so the world gets better. That is.
Well, and again, I am there with you. And to the effect that, silolization, compartmentalization tends to be to the favor of those who are further up the managerial ladder, in as much as they have a sort of higher viewpoint on what some of those silos even consist of and the interrelationships thereof. It's anything that sort of relies on intellectual property. Again, post-secondary institutions create a lot of intellectual property, both on behalf of the institution, which is what most people sign away when they, go to work for a place. It's kind of a trade-off. But the fact that there is commercialization, the fact that there is monetization associated with the products and processes of a lot of post-secondaries, again, that sort of speaks to factors which kind of make the drive towards open education, as it were, I mean that colloquially, and also towards a more open and transparent kind of approach towards teaching, learning, and, the buildup that goes into that, right? So.
And with all this silo mentality and cognitive territories and all that, one thing I really love is what's happened with STEM and then what's happened with STEAM, science, technology, engineering, math, or science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, where people are seeing it. Thank goodness. People are seeing that it's like, okay, we're being too restrictive. There's a good value to it, but it's too restrictive, so let's branch out and see what else we can do. Let's find new things. I heard a little study. I don't know if it's true, if it's marketing BS, where 50 years ago, what you learned at school, you could use in a job for 18 years, roughly 18 to 20 years before you had to retrain to learn new skills.
A good shelf life for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And now the number is 18 months to a year and a half to 2 years, and you're constantly retraining. It's you get a new phone. Okay, I got to learn a whole bunch of new stuff. I got a new computer. So what did they just do? How did they just screw up my email? How do I fix it? We have to figure out a way to be more efficient and reduce the loads on people. And I think the interdisciplinary approach is a way to go.
Well, very much so. And I think the kind of interdisciplinarity which you are describing, I sort of see a lot of what I'm doing in, say, the English classroom as having a lot. I pay a fairly good amount of attention to multiple literacies, right? So not just literacy within the context of the academic discipline that I'm teaching, English literature, but rather I'm having, you know, just in terms of what I'm even asking students to do. I mean, having students, you know, for instance, write something in a Word document and send it to you by email as an attachment, that in itself is actually a challenge for a great number of first-year college students because they didn't have to do that in high school. Some of them are encountering word processing software for the first time. And I'm not saying it's exclusively the international cohort, but I mean, again, there are people who have been in this country in my classes, you know, for 3-4 months, maybe in some cases, a lot of cases a lot longer. But I mean, the whole idea of just sort of being able to take it for granted that everybody sort of coming into your teaching situation has a relatively, you know, you can rely on them to have certain levels of skills in certain areas, that has gone out the window. I believe that now. And so part of what I try and do is give people the opportunity to, okay, before we have a heavy assessment, which involves a PowerPoint presentation, here's a chance in a low stakes situation to just kind of do a PowerPoint about your favorite Canadian poet or whatever, and just fiddle around with it. And again, the technology skill literacy required for that is kind of its own thing. And so if I'm giving students the opportunity to kind of do some of this stuff in my class and try some of this stuff out, hopefully that kind of lifts the wider endeavor in terms of what they're doing in their other classes and things like that. I hope so.
Very cool.
Anyway, now, bro,
do people have favorite Canadian poets?
I told them if you don't have, you're gonna. I'm just like, it's like, but it was not. It was actually an opportunity where, for instance, I was talking about my deceased friend and poet Joe Blades from Bredeton, and just in terms of preparing to talk about him and some other Bredeton poets. You know, you kind of do the Google search and just kind of see what's there. And some of the resources that I found just in terms of places that are curating Joe's work and the work of other Canadian poets, I'm like, this is good as a resource in and of itself. So, for instance, demonstrating, you know, the use of the University of Toronto English Literature Department Archive. They have on their website a whole page, like a clickable page of links just made up of Canadian poets' names on it. Contemporary and then, you know, pre-contemporary, I suppose. And that's actually a resource that I would go to if I wanted to learn more myself, if I wanted to find out about poets who were adjacent to Alden Nolan or whatever. And that's something where if I hadn't been doing that Google search about my deceased pal, Joe, the poet, for Bredeton, I wouldn't have even necessarily been aware of that significant resource, which has all kinds of info about other Canadian poets. And so when I share that with the students, it's not just, you know, here's some poems and a little bit of life about Joe Blades. It's about, okay, and in addition, here's where you can go for your assignments about poetry generally, where you are in charge of selecting your own topics and your own poets, as it were, to use for the assignment. So Joe is still teaching me things, as it turns out.
Very nice. That's great to hear.
I think so.
Now, what about Robert Service? Creation of Sam McGee.
Highly dope. I love it.
Okay. That when you said that, the first name that came to my head was Robert Service. So that
people
was
might,
what, 100?
Well, I'm gonna be interested. I'm gonna be interested. So that's sort of why I spread it open as wide as you can. And it's also sort of a wink to the fact that 70% of my students at this point, 60-70%, are newcomers to Canada. And it's sort of like, okay, well, you don't have one. Here's an opportunity to try a few out and find one that speaks to you. And that I think is way more of an approach that is conducive to engaging with the students, giving them a chance to defer to their own interests and abilities, and also handing them the accountability for finding it and sharing it with me, because that takes a certain level of literacy, digital literacy and curation to make that happen. And then to put the text into an MLA citation, again, that's sort of something else. And it's a multi-purpose way of helping lift skill levels in a few areas. And sure, Robert Service, cool. You know, I got Leonard Cohen is there because, I mean, he was a legit poet as well as a singer and songwriter. Again, Alden Nolan, personal favorite of mine. That's probably the first name that jumps into my mind if I were to just automatically try and name who my favorite all-around Canadian poet would be. I like to think that people have somebody that they remember from somewhere back in school that kind of resonates with them. But again, if not, here's an opportunity to just very briefly touch down on the ginormous iceberg that is Canadian literature and just find one little aspect of that that you can sort of examine for larger investigations into theme, character, setting, use of language, literary devices, and all that. Again, that's, I think, more effective than me just saying, well, you know, here's three poems by this one poet, and you're all going to talk about it. I mean, that would kill me to mark, for one thing. I mean, that would just destroy me. Like, I don't know how people would do that. I mean, literally choosing specifically the topic and then having to go through all those papers dealing with exactly the same topic. I'd be fried as a teacher. So it's selfish as well as, you know, hopefully all that other good stuff.
Yeah. It would be tough to have a will to live marking hundreds of those. Ooh, that's brutal.
It's because you have to give them the right amount of attention. You have to give it amount of respect to comment on it. And that means setting yourself up mentally and physically to be able to do that both with a good level of detail and care, but then also with an efficiency of economy in terms of getting them to them in a timely manner as well, right? And so that's been something that I have been working with, and I am just, again, grateful for the opportunity to be doing so. And I think, again, looking at things holistically as part of a wider educational endeavor is something that for me is maybe a lot more significant and tangible and meaningful, because I'm in the teaching primarily front-facing kind of role right now, as it would have been, say, 6 months ago when I was back doing e-learning for the commissionaires in St. John. Bye. It was a while ago. Bye. 6 months feels like a lifetime ago, but it wasn't. Anyway, bro, so I think we're through the references. You got some pretty cool images here. I really like that first image you got.
Oh, that's, the silo mentality is getting out of hand, and it's somebody's created a little castle in a cubicle firm with a moat and crocodiles or alligators or whatever.
Right, right. You think about all of what they could have done besides set that up if they hadn't been concerned from the top down about a silo approach. They could have, made something with a little bit more tangible value to the company, as it were. They could have made a better quality widget. They could have made more widgets instead of putting up that, you know, the barricade with the crocodiles and whatnot.
There have been times in my life where it's like, go talk to so-and-so. They're the one that knows that. And I felt like I was walking through the crocodiles.
Right.
It's like, oh, man, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to get told no. Right. I'm going to get brushed off. I'm going to get whatevered. And it's like, yeah, okay, I just don't want to deal with that.
I spent 4 years working at a place like that.
Yeah.
That was what it was like for 4 years. Pretty demoralizing.
Oh, I know absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, and then what else we got? Anything that's sort of jumping out here? I like the faculty towers as opposed to faulty towers? Is that like a riff on that concept or what? Or am I just
saying something? I wouldn't be surprised. Listeners, if you go to analogtrope.com/podcast, the website that we've got, the third picture in place is all these faculty buildings, but they're in the shapes of cogs, and everything kind of goes together, and every faculty's got its own cog-shaped building, and yeah, everything has to click a certain way, or forget it, right? The
right.
machine doesn't work, the equipment doesn't operate unless it's just so.
Yep.
And I really like that graphic. When I found that, it was like, yeah, that's sweet.
It resonates. It lands.
So I have three last things. I have the word of the podcast, which is silo, because okay. I just love the concept. And we got to say the concept out loud before we start to try to tear it down, because I want to tear it down. The question is...
Yeah, awesome. Just kudos for that one, bro. That is a good way of articulating that.
And my question, thank you, is how can we reduce the cognitive territories that limit knowledge creation? Because I hate it. I hate it so much. Like, when you think of the real sciences, what are you thinking? Like, biology? Chemistry? Right? It's physics. And it's like, I'm in love with botany right now. I just collected 9 or 10 wheelbarrows full of pumpkins and squash from my garden. Now I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I'm loving learning about the agriculture part. But that's not a real science. No. That might as well just be geology. Geology doesn't count as a real science. Everybody makes fun of those rock jockeys or whatever.
Horticulture?
Yeah, can that be real? No, that's a trade. That's not a science or whatever the BS is.
Yeah, I got you. You're playing simpleton's advocate.
I'm trying.
Well,
and I have two phrases.
And I think that's a hell of a way to spend the afternoon. I've spent the entire portion of my day and a lot of yesterday unmoving in my bed because my brain literally just needed to have nothing to do except click at my phone every couple of hours. And so I'm grateful for this podcast for actually getting me up in the afternoon to do something other than just kind of wait for my next slot to teach. That's not insignificant benefit to all this for me, bro. So,
right on.
Yeah, man. And
so my last thing are the phrases of the podcast. You had one I really loved, which is okay. Administrative bloat is a great term.
That was yours. You came up with that.
Oh, you said the phrase, though, didn't you?
Well,
I swear to you.
My recollection, and that may be faulty, is that you mentioned it within the context of one of these articles,
yep.
And I said, that's a great phrase. So.
Okay. Okay, and my second one is, do people have a favorite Canadian poet? That one's definitely mine.
I am hoping that more humans on this earth will be able to say yes to that question by the end of my semester. That's
right on.
One of my modest goals for this whole enterprise. So I appreciate the question there, pal.
Very cool.
Dope.
And that's what I've got about academic disciplines and silos.
Yeah, that's extremely rad. I'm really grateful, again, just to kind of be able to even talk to such matters. Because for me, when I was sort of in my previous role doing e-learning and stuff, it was like, okay, it's an opportunity to reflect on practice, you know, and think about what practice could look like. And now I'm very much enmeshed in practicing on a frontline level. So now I sort of get to look at this whole thing as what can I draw from this, you know, from this kind of practical or hands-on whatever teaching, you know, thing that I'm in now. what can I draw from that that's going to be helpful for other people? So it's kind of going from like sort of a macro kind of thing to a micro kind of thing, but weirdly both with the same kind of objective, right? So,
yeah.
Man, I've enjoyed this. I'm really, really glad, Doug, that we had a chance to do this.
I'm glad we could connect and catch our parents and have a go.
And thanks for the chat beforehand. I'm not going to necessarily pull out all those personal goings on, but I have to tell you, friends, seriously, I've been talking to my students about the importance of self-care and wellness. I've been talking to them a lot about that because of, you know, the nature of what we've been teaching and such like that. But I would just say that anybody, if you have anybody in your life that you can just sort of talk to and vent at a little bit, you know, that is always, always a good thing. I'm grateful to have Dr. Doug Reed in my life for such purpose and, you know, others as well. But again, I just think that as we go into the darkening period of the year, it's like I'm in northern Alberta, and what I've noticed is the sun doesn't even start to come up now until 8:30 a.m. I'm like, what? 8:30 in the morning? Are you nuts? It's dark until then. And we're starting to now get to the point where getting dark around 7:30-ish. So, I mean, the northern latitudes are shrinking the amount of light in terms of my location. And so I would just say to anybody who's out there, be aware seasonal change can affect people. Be aware of, you know, light sensitivity, your body's need for rest, circadian rhythms, eating properly, you know, giving yourself permission to feel bad for no particular reason and know that it's just kind of build up from your body and your mind for something that needs expression. And to not be so hard on oneself when you don't meet your own best expectations, I suppose. That's what I want to go out with. So appreciate the opportunity, folks. Glad you could join us, and we're going to be seeing you again sooner than later.
Right on. Have a good one, everybody. See you next time. Later, Gators.